Welcome to Big Blend Radio's art show featuring Victoria Chick, a contemporary figurative artist and early 19th and 20th century print collector. Hey, everybody, super excited today to talk about burial sites. That's something you wouldn't think about for art, right? But Victoria is back here today to talk about American burial markers. So like our tombstones, our epitaphs, if you will. Like if you've been to Tombstone, Arizona, there's the Epitaph newspaper that's been going for years, and Boot Hill Cemetery. And you go in there and you want to see where Wyatt Earp, you know, and the Clantons and all of that, where they are buried. But we're going to go way back when to colonial times in America and kind of look at the art and what artists were using, or I should say stoneworkers. So welcome back, Victoria. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'm glad to be talking to you again today. And especially this topic is really interesting, and I hope your listeners will find it interesting. For those of us who do go into cemeteries, not to see anybody know that we know is buried there, but just because they're so interesting, this topic, I think is, interesting from a historical standpoint and from an artistic standpoint, and from a, the standpoint of actually making tombstones and how that was done. And some of the burial practices were pretty interesting too. You mentioned colonial stuff, and of course, that we're talking about the 1600s, which is quite a long time ago now. And
when I was getting all my photos together for this, you have to, like, Lisa, no, the colonial period is not in, you know, 1700s, just reminding you.
when we think about old times, sometimes the time gets compressed in our minds, and we remember certain little things from history classes we had in high school, and it's just sort of all a blur, but colonial times were the 1600s, and people first arrived here, like the Puritans and the Plymouth Rock and all that, in the early 1600s. And people, they had a very hard winter, so a lot of people died that first year. And burial was difficult. I mean, you're talking about stony ground, and you're talking about frozen ground. So a lot of times those people that died were buried very shallowly, with maybe just a rock over their grave that would have their initials scratched in it, if that. Or if the ground was totally frozen, they might just have to let the body, you know, protect the body as best they could, and then they'll bury it 6 months later when the ground thawed out. So life was difficult. And and so was burial. By the middle of the 1600s, things had improved, though. There were stone workers by that time that had immigrated to the United States from Europe. So they had skills, and they were very good skills, but they were limited in those skills by the kind of material that was available wherever they landed, you know, wherever the town was or the area was that they landed. So slate was the biggest material, the most prevalent material that was used for grave markers at that time. And one of the reasons that they used it was because it was naturally occurring in plains, flat plains, so they could dig it down a little bit and lift a section of it up. And so these sections maybe were like 2 or 3 inches thick, and they were easily scratched on, and they were easily kind of chiseled out to make the dates of the name of the person who had died.
So I find this so fascinating about how much work goes into it. And just even the craft of, you know, being a magazine person, born and bred, right, into this industry. And my family heritage is, you know, my great-grandfather was a typesetter. in a newspaper,
Ah, okay.
in England, and
Yes.
then came to the States. And at that point, we're looking at those big plates and everything. And then I know this all, by the way, this topic all came from talking about Victoria's recent article on engraving, the art and history of engraving. So then we're like, well, what about
Right.
tombstones now? Okay, now we're in.
Yeah.
So then now rabbit hole begins. But what I find very fascinating, having, gone through the world of printing magazines and even what we do now, even as podcasting, there's the world of editing, right? Which takes a huge amount of time. But
Right.
you, I've written an obituary before, which was for a very prolific person, prolific in that he led a prolific, a big life, not in that he was a naughty boy. But, well,
Yeah.
maybe. But anyway, a little bit. But anyway, I had to write this huge thing, and it was like if I left things out, and no matter what I could have done, someone's going to get mad. But in obituaries, it's a very interesting thing, and then you have to have this shortened version of someone's life. And then it kind of reminds me of running a magazine when during printing times where you could only have so many pages. And same thing as
Right.
newspapers, right? Where you had to get down to the headlines and here's your stuff, and you didn't have time to, blah, 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 like I'm doing right now. I'm blah, blah, blahing, but I'm saying you can't blah, blah, blah on a tombstone. You have to get down to it.
No.
And the okay, so then you're actually chiseling, and if you screw up your chisel work, you have to start again. That sucks.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Well,
So
that's never happened to me, but I can imagine that it would be pretty disgusting if I was a stonemason that was working on this. So yeah,
yeah.
you have to be careful, and because
And choosing the words are for, yeah.
those stones were hard to come by, and it's not like you just grab another piece of paper. So
Yeah.
they had to be very careful. I've never seen anything that how many times they made mistakes and had to start over, but probably it wasn't very many.
I would be a little nervous. And then whatever you said, of course the dates, right? Who the person is. So we see that in all of this. But the artwork to me in the 1600s, the colonial times, I've
Yes.
got it now. It's the 1600s for sure. But the
Yep.
artwork to me is very Celtic with the swirlies. I don't know how to explain the swirlies. There's a picture in Victoria's article. Everyone, the link to the article's in the show notes and also up on blendradioandtv.com right on the homepage if you're listening at the third Saturday of November. It's there, the fourth week too. But
Well, you know what? That's interesting what you're saying about the swirlies, because a lot of these people came from England. A number of people came from Ireland. By that time, the burial in or the grave markers in those countries were influenced greatly by Celtic art. So they did those kind of intricate interlacing designs on the tombstones, and you see some of that in a smaller version usually at first, because their stones weren't quite as big in the 1600s, but as they were in England. The other thing that they would do is they would often have what we would call it a death's head, that's DEATHS head, which would be sometimes a very crude skull or a very simplified face. And usually on either side of this skull or this face, there would be a stylized version of a pair of wings, like an angel.
okay.
And that was a real common symbol on tombstones early. Sometimes they don't look religious, like we sometimes think of angels as looking religious, but these were more severe. I think they were meant to remind us that life is short, and but with the wings, that was also an indication that they believed in a life afterwards. So I think it was perceived then as positive.
But also, like, we're flying, our body's flown up. Like, so it's not necessarily angel wings, but you've taken flight. You know, I remember a friend saying, in everyone, I mean, it's hard. I mean, religion plays a role in everything in regards to people dying, right? Spirituality or lack of that, right? But I remember a friend said, a friend had died, and he said, God came and put his hand on so and so's shoulder and took him home, kind of thing. And so I feel like there's always this feeling of flight and like a spirit leaving the body, like the body is a shell. And I find it really fascinating that we're putting this body in a box, which is another shell in the, you know, then later we have this cremation part and there's all these different ways to die and green burials, which are interesting. But it's kind of interesting when you know, okay, well, we don't know. I mean, whatever. I don't want to get in that. I don't want to get in trouble. I'm going to get all these emails. But I think but it is a sign of the times. Like we always talk about this with art and how it's so connected to history and what is happening at that time and those belief systems. So when you're saying it's kind of
Well,
like there's this beautiful swirly, but the wings are kind of crude in a way. Like you're saying, it's not like angelic with the marble.
Like you say, there's different practices and different beliefs. And I mean, if we talk about Egyptian burial, for instance, which there's a lot known about that, and we it's not threatening our beliefs right now for the most part because it's historic. I mean, it's not prehistorical, it's historical, but it's a different country, it's a different culture completely. We are studying it and it's interesting. When we talk about America, we're getting a little closer to home. Even in the 1600s, we're closer. And we're, you know, a lot of people came to the United States for religious reasons. So their history is bound up in their burial. So I think nobody should, you know, people, we look at burials, some of the markers that are there, are just practical markers. Some are express their religious beliefs and then, or not, or some express no religious belief. They can all be interesting to us, I think. I go through cemeteries. Well, speaking of cemeteries, because back here, back up in the time we're talking about, there were no cemeteries. And
Oh, where you are
cemeteries didn't.
in Silver City, New Mexico,
No, no,
what you're saying?
no, no,
I
no.
mean,
Not
what do you
here.
mean?
Back in the 1600s.
Oh, okay. So the oh yeah. So there was, that's right. There weren't cemeteries then. Those were church things, right? At then.
Cemeteries did not exist. So if you didn't live near a church that you were maybe a member of, you
You're
had
out
to
of
look
luck.
someplace to bury the body. I mean, and of course there were plenty of vacant ground. And if you were in a town, all you'd do was find a vacant lot, and you'd bury your person. You might, I mean,
I'm sorry, I got the giggles now.
it wasn't like throwing out trash, you know, but the areas that were bur that people buried were close. And many times they weren't maintained. They were just vacant areas. Sometimes graver robbers came along, so the body would be dug up, robbed of any kind of valuable stuff that might have been buried with them. And they would be, these kind of areas became really unsanitary because about the only other regular place that people would bury people was a churchyard, and we've all probably all seen examples of that. But then a churchyard usually had a wall around it, and they ran out of space. So it became a problem as the population got larger, and somebody came up with a bright idea of going outside of town, and having a nice place. So they would plat off a certain amount of acreage, and they would put streets in it, and they sold lots. And people that seemed to be a really a good plan. And one of the things they would do, they'd plant trees, they would make it very park-like, which is a great thing, because this would be by the middle of the 18th century. They didn't have parks yet. Towns did not have parks. And so people would go out to the cemetery area, and they had to have a picnic, and they would visit their family, their ancestors' tombstones. It was a very pleasant, activity that
But
they partake.
I love that because, the cemeteries like the ones we've been to is mostly 1800s mostly, right? The historic cemeteries that Nancy and I have been to. And as many of you know, listeners, we travel the country full time documenting parks and public lands, and now graveyards and cemeteries are becoming that because they are peaceful places, they are protected places, they're historical, a lot of so much history, and also underfunded. And so I just always have to poke whenever we talk about cemeteries. I'm just like, hello, people. Master gardeners are going in there for free and doing upkeep where they can. There is so much to keeping an actual tombstone clean and still present without defacing it. Historians freak out when family history buffs go in there and do rubbings on them, to get the image of the tombstone. But it's true. But there, I mean, both, I agree with both sides. So I'm not going to get in that fight because, like, get what you can, right? But these places do actually need funding and support and help. And when you go, you'll find out about people you never even knew existed that had these amazing life stories. And if you're like me and Nancy and many friends of ours in Victoria, you'll go down rabbit holes. But the art is there. The sayings can be really funny. Some can be really sad. You can see mass graves too across this country, children's deaths with little crosses, Bibles kind of. I think they're Bibles if they're a book, right? As a tomb. So a lot of that, statues, and we'll talk about all that with Victoria, but I understand also there's something beautiful about a family going to a graveyard as a park and a picnic. And you've also got to think like around that time, we were also going to hangings and having picnics too, before then and during that time frame. So we're a little weird. But the graveyards, you've got to also think, when cars were invented and how if these grave sites were far away from your house, this was a family outing and it takes time. And maybe they're like going, hey, we're talking to Uncle Joe and he really would like this piece of fried chicken. I don't know if they were frying chicken then, but like, he would like this bread pudding. So here's your bread pudding. We're eating it for you. I don't know, but there's something of a family outing honoring those who have passed on that I think is quite beautiful, personally.
One thing about I agree. One thing about cemeteries, I think, and that going to visit gravestones and leaving flowers and stuff and talking about who's gone before you and what they were like by the people who remember them and passing that on to younger people who never met them. And it binds the family together. I think a lot of this stopped or when probably in the 1950s when people started working for companies that would transfer them somewhere else. So a community that had a big extended family in it became more rare. And because people and families started getting better jobs elsewhere, and families got scattered all over the country. And that's still happening. So you kind of lose something of a communal, I guess, or familial activity or feeling. And that's kind of sad, but that's just the way things happened, and that's the way life's changed. So,
And that's why families are spread out everywhere across the country and around the world. It's about their
and I think
careers.
yeah, yeah. But one of the things that seems to have filled that gap is the interest that people have in their ancestors, and so they start doing ancestral research, and that's a very popular activity now too. So that might be more kind of a reaction to the loss of actually visiting a cemetery.
Well, there's Find a Grave website that is really helpful to
Yes.
go check that out. But it, I think back then that's how family history, family unit, community, especially farm families, and sometimes they were buried on their farm,
Yes,
there's
right.
parks that we've gone to in the country where graveyards are part of them, national forests where graveyards are part of them. There's family graveyards, like you. I don't know. We end up there,
Right.
and they were like, "Oh, you better not open that gate. Like, what are we doing? Hallowed,
Yeah.
we're going to go trot on their hallowed ground. That's wrong." And I
Right.
feel weird. Even, I've taken a gazillion photos of graveyards that we've been through that are historical graveyards that you're allowed to go in, but there's like this also these private graveyards that you end up stumbling of, like literally on travels
Yeah.
of back roads, country roads, and you go. Farms and some of them end up in historic places, like protected historic sites and things. But there's a privacy, like you don't even want to photograph them. And then I'm like, you should, because you're protecting it in some way. Because most graveyards, I mean, like I was saying about the funding, are overgrown, and you're getting to this. We're getting to this point that we actually can't read these sites anymore.
Yeah.
These tombstones, these pieces of art, because some of them have sculptures. Some of them have faces on that they start to wear with the weather. And
Right.
I feel very passionate that we should look at this as art.
Well,
Really.
it is. When I was in my teenage years, I lived in Liberty, Missouri, and there were a lot of old homes there that were constructed way before the Civil War and a little bit after the Civil War, and they were farmsteads, and almost everyone had a little patch that was had a little tiny a little fence around it, a little wrought iron fence, and their family was buried there. The house next to this, of course, there still were family members there, and I sometimes wonder, if part of that family was still occupying the house and taking care of the land and taking care of the cemetery. But sometimes families break up, they die out,
Wow, that's true.
the house gets sold to a stranger if it's not already historical, and maybe or maybe not, the new owners will care for the cemetery. But there's probably a lot of places like that.
Yeah, there are. I know that living in the Midwest, that like Jesse James, there's
Yeah,
all these gangs,
right.
right? And so, and Silver City is known for Jesse James living there. And we've been to his grave, and no, not it is no, I've got Billy the Kid, sorry, not Jesse
Billy the
James.
Kid,
Jesse
yep.
James. Jesse James is up in the Midwest. Oh, we don't know
Kearney,
where we are
Missouri.
when. Yeah. And we went there.
Carney.
Yep. We went there. And they have good murals in that town, by the way. And it's just interesting because some of them were buried on what's now people's backyards, pieces of land, if they have like acreage. And there's, it's fascinating that, they either take a, oh, you know what, I'm going to take care of this person's land or their site, their resting place, or not, and, so they'll be kind of not this artistic thing, whereas you go into graveyards like we've done, like Easton, Pennsylvania. A lot of the photos that you'll see in Victoria's article, Easton, Pennsylvania, very historic, including George Taylor was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And we got America's bandstand leader. We've got, there's so many historic people. You can go to Asheville, North Carolina, the historic Montfort District, over 600 Victorian homes.
Yeah.
And Thomas Wolfe, the author, and O. Henry, the author, are buried there. So you start getting into this little crazy land of, A lot of people will go like, oh, I love this person. I want to go see Jim Morrison's grave in France or Edgar Allan Poe's grave. You know, I want to go see that. But I say, wherever you go, go to the historic cemetery and just let it happen. Like, go look and read the tombstone, look at the art on it, find out who's behind it, and look, because some people, I think, like Little Rock Cemetery, the cemetery that we were there, Mount Holly Cemetery, and some of the photos are in there. Everyone was buried just where they had the land. Like, you're the next body, you're going in next to the next person. It didn't matter if you were a slave or you were a politician or a prostitute. That politicians and prostitutes usually get buried next to each other. Ha ha ha. Sorry. Had to say that. I know we've talked about that before, Victoria, but I had to bring it up. But it's true. The dentist will be, you know, next to the lawyer or not, or, you know, the, you know, so it was kind of an interesting thing. And that's kind of the cemetery's kind of history and legacy, is that everyone was buried wherever. Whereas some cemeteries you go in, like, this is this rich family, they owned the town. There was a cemetery, Rapides Parish in Louisiana, central Louisiana near Alexandria, and the founder of the town of Boise has his own section of the graveyard. Like, his, this is me, this is mine, it's my family. I have my picket fence. No, it's not white, but it's, you know, wrought iron. And then down the hill, you'll find a Revolutionary War soldier and a hero that's buried there. Like, that's crazy to me. Like, I mean, how did the Revolutionary War, but then there was huge wars that were fought in Bayou Rapids, you know, Civil War
Well, yeah,
history.
that's interesting that a revolutionary soldier would, because there's quite a bit of time that's between those events, but it's not necessarily unusual for Civil War,
No.
like a monument for a Civil War soldier, or a monument, not maybe not even in a cemetery, but just out in public, in a park, say, or at the courthouse. When the Civil War occurred, both North and South, I mean, there was such a division was so great that the feelings were raw for a long time. So when people were buried, they usually didn't have a sculpture as part of a tombstone, and that kind of monument didn't occur until about 50 years after the Civil War, and they would then honor a particular person with a sculpture, which I thought was interesting, but it was understandable.
Yeah, it's it when
And by that time, of course, the ability to make bronze sculpture had come about in the United States, and that was because of the Industrial Revolution at the end of the 1800s. So they went from, oh, you know, just finding a type of rock that was locally available, to being able to expand the kind of materials they used.
Well, what about when did the marble come in? Because anything that's white, right, is
Well,
kind of the marble.
yeah.
Because some people have actual, well, in Louisiana, you'll find a lot of raised coffins. Well, not coffins, but actual tombs, right?
Well,
Because of the flooding.
especially in New Orleans, you see people buried above the ground in crypts because the water table's too high to really bury anybody. But
Kind of freaky.
yeah, it is freaky.
I'm sorry.
especially when you see it for the first time, it's very different. But then, I guess a lot of things are different if we don't get around. So,
You just kind of go, hello. I talk to everybody as I go through. I always do. And that's the weirdest thing about trying to get photos. And if you're searching for a specific grave, like a historic person or animal, because some, like that horse I was telling you about before the recording, that had been in the Civil War, has his own grave. And he was known as Sam, and he was in the Civil War in six battles and made it through. And it was in Coldwater, Michigan. And we still have not found this. But I'm trying to scramble around and get this for horse stories, because we do that as we travel too. And lo and behold, can't. But apparently it's pretty, prominent, but they didn't have, again, like these are like some of our parks that need the funding. So I'm trying to get the story, but I'm scrambling around the graveyard. I'm like, God, I hope I'm not walking on you. Like, I'm sorry. Like, as I'm walking through, like in between graves, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I'm thinking, what are you thinking? They're dead. They don't feel you walking on you. Like, but it's weird. And then you get to someone who's raised up and you're like what? You're ready to float? Like, it's kind of a weird, and it's a weird thing going through these cemeteries, but it does kind of connect you about what the life force of life is. I think it's very important, but yeah, go back up to the marble, because I find that like that's going to be heavy. These people have
Okay,
actual
well,
above ground tombs that are marble,
yeah.
like they ain't floating.
When the well, marble quarry or a marble area was discovered in Vermont, and that's where most of the white colored marble comes from in the United States. Still, they thought white marble was the right thing to use for tombstones, although there were. Did I say, yeah, marble. Then there's granite. Granite tends to be more multicolored, various shades of gray, sometimes rusty color in there. Both of these stones were hard stones, whereas sandstone and slate and stuff were soft. In order to quarry the hard stone, they really needed better tools, and those came about through the Industrial Revolution. So that's why you start seeing that more in cemeteries that are in the 1800s or late 1800s and the 1900s. So, but the other thing is, this was I always thought was interesting was in art history, archaeology, they did not really. Archaeology was not a field of study until the middle of the 1800s. So when they were when and this was a time of when people started traveling a lot too. Just they would decide to go to exotic places. So they might go to Greece, or they might go to Rome, or they might go to Egypt, any of these countries that were that they considered exotic and valuable because they were old, really. And so when they would see these things, all the statuary that was Greek statuary, some Roman statuary, certainly Egyptian, all of that had been colored. It had been painted. Well, no matter what the rock material was, it was painted. So, but by the time archaeologists came along, all that paint had worn away. So they said that people got the impression that they were always white, and that was correct. So you wouldn't want to put paint on anything. So what you start to see is a lot of gravestones, statuary, and sculptures that's white marble, or sometimes it was even cast metal that they would paint white.
I've seen different colors
Because
too. I've seen other rock, like pink.
yeah,
I've seen
yes,
metal. I don't
yeah.
know what, maybe it's bronze. I've seen now in South Africa, Ishlawanda rock, which was a huge battle with Shaka Zulu and the Brits, and he kicked their butts, rightly so at that time of history. I mean, the Battle of Ishlawanda Rock was a huge. It's amazing. And Shaka Zulu to me is like this amazing warrior and got me into understanding battle strategy. And I still don't understand it, but like what he did was he just really circled the British and kicked their butts. And he set up his warriors to run on thorns, run on hot coals, not Tony Robbins stuff. I mean, real stuff. No offense to Tony Robbins, but like they were doing it for their life. And so they could run barefoot, whereas the British are in their boots going, oh, I'm going through the African Bosveld, and didn't quite understand the land, right? Whereas they did. They knew the thorn trees. They knew this, and they could run on thorns. That's why he made them run barefoot. And so he did what was called, he went and did, it's kind of like the buffalo. So if you look at a buffalo head with the horns, right, he kind of did what was a buffalo and surrounded what was called a kraal in the Dutch terms, which is like everybody would set camp
Corral.
and he would surround. We say kraal, Dutch is kraal in America, corral. And he would circle him and just boom, you're out. Well, anyway, a lot of people died. Zulu and also in British. And if you go to Isla Wanda Rock, as a kid, this is my memory as a kid. So like I could be wrong on some of the historical stuff, but this is what got me into history, this moment. Like it changed my life, this place. And it was seeing the mass graves. And think about this. Before this, I'd been through England as a kid and gone and seen where people were executed, the execution things where they put their head and their hands in and chopped the guillotines. I've seen all of that stuff, and it freaked me out as a little kid. But this really did, for some reason, where all these stones, and they whitewashed them, and to let people know not to, that was all they had, were stones and whitewash that people could afford back then. To, I mean, we're, I, God don't, I can't tell you the years. But that's what they had. And so that's how you knew when you went to see this pile of stones with whitewash. They did a lot of whitewashing on buildings, back then over there. But this was a way to recognize you, this is not just a pile of stones. It's not
And
like
you
where
don't
people put
disturb
trail
it.
markers. You don't disturb it. And it really got me because each stone is to represent a body. And then I'm like, holy crap, man, this is a lot of people died in this battle. And when you realize how brutal it was, and it was stabbing and cannons from the British, but actual the Africans going in to stab, like you've got to think about how bloody this battle was. It's like Gettysburg has that same feeling to me that just blows my mind, like in my soul. Like I had to sit down, like Nancy and I had to like go away and like calm down. It was so overwhelming and emotional about how bloody these battles are, and how, when you think about how war was then, it's not like, oh, laser point and zap and kill. This was intimate combat. And so those graves just, and just to have these little stones, like, and maybe they missed one or somebody threw a rock someday and that was that. Like, you don't know really how many people you were standing on, you know? So Rwanda is the same thing. They just put all these bodies in one big pit and covered up and put stones on top and said, there you go, the Rwanda genocide. That's what, that's that, like mass graves. That's it. No fancy rock art for you. That's it. I mean, maybe they did it now, but back then the wars were, I mean, when you go to Gettysburg, you do see a lot of marble. You see these amazing sculptures, whether you like the person or not, these, this is art to behold it. I mean, the artists to do this, because this is something that has to last eternity, pretty much, when you think about what you're doing in a gravesite. I think the artists, the people writing the work, the writing on there, what is said, if they have room to do it, if they have the money to do it, the finances, that's the other huge part, right? That's supposed to last eternity in a way. That's the feeling, right? So, wow. Sorry, I went off on that tangent. I can't, this is a rabbit hole conversation for me, sorry.
Well, that's okay. I'm used to that. So that's what makes my I always look forward to talking to you because I don't know where we're going when
You
we
never
start.
know. But if you think about, you know, here's these pebbles put on top of people, whitewashed, versus here's your marble. It's like a night and day thing, right? But so my thing is like, okay, so there's all these, and it was kind of in the same era, I would say. I've got to think, yeah, it's a similar time frame, at least within 100 years, you know?
When people when cemeteries started and people could buy lots, some people bought many lots, and so they would put it like a they would build a mausoleum because their belief was that they had to protect the body. That's sort of like the same attitude that the Egyptians had. We have to protect the body. Other people had a different view that that you're ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and you're already gone. You're already gone somewhere else by the time your body is buried. So there were all kinds of belief systems going on at the time, and still are. And one of the things that happened as the result of the Industrial Revolution, I mean, I think that the Industrial Revolution was changed so many things. I mean, in all areas of life, but in as far as burial goes and making gravestones, you had better equipment. You could cut marble slabs bigger. Now you have trains. You could transport the heavier pieces. So you could distribute your distribution increased exponentially, really, as the trains tracks were put down. And so anyway, the people who weren't wealthy then started to be able to have larger and larger gravestones if they wanted them. And so you start to see more monuments building. That wasn't just headstones, it was monuments for a person or for a family. Sometimes people would buy a plot, you know, many plots right next to each other, so their whole with the idea that their whole family would eventually be buried there together. That was an interesting when you go through a cemetery, sometimes you'll see tiny stones really next to big monuments, but it just more or less depends on the era in which the person died. And then in the early early 20th century, the early 1900s, they started selling monuments through Montgomery Ward and Company, the catalog
Oh my
people,
God,
and
they
the
did that for houses too. Montgomery Ward
yeah,
had
oh yeah.
houses. Didn't they have kit houses too?
Yes,
Didn't they
then
do
they
that?
had that all, yeah. And so then, they were so old. By that time, photography was doing very well, and somebody in France figured out a way to fuse a photograph. I don't know if they just used the negative or they used the photograph itself, but I think there was silver involved. There was some kind of metal. They would fire it onto a porcelain plaque, and they would put a frame around it, and they would put the picture of the person, the photograph of a person, on the tombstone, which is really interesting when if you've never seen those before. They advertised them. I thought it was their copy for their advertising said that they called them eternal portraits, and that they gave the resting place of the dead a living personality, which they sounds very poetic.
Yeah.
But I thought it was for the first time I thought it was startling, because some of them were lasted pretty well and some of them did not. So sometimes the image of the person that they wanted to last really decomposed. So that's kind of sad. But
That
then
is, I mean,
yeah.
yeah.
And Sears got into it. Sears company got into graves too. You could by that time in the 1900s, you could buy really big marble markers, up to you could probably get them like 9 or 10 feet high, and ordered, and they would scribe, and it didn't cost a lot to inscribe them with the name and so forth, whatever you wanted on there. I think it was 2 to 6 cents per letter. Probably 6 cents were bigger letters, but and they continued selling cemetery monuments through 1949. So that was, I mean, times change, and sometimes the changes are really good, so, even for people like me who always resist change, you know.
Yeah, but you don't at all. You're an artist and contemporary, and you your art is sparkling. man, like your mind goes everywhere, and it's like it's amazing to me what you produce. I mean it, like in a good way. It's like I would never have thought of this, but you do. And
Well,
no, that and you are contemporary for sure, and you do go with the change. I find this whole conversation so fascinating about, what how we represent those who have passed on, and the religion does come in, and if you've done something bad, that comes in. You're not going to get a big
right.
monument if you're, I wonder what Charles Manson's grave looks like if he
Oh
even has
gosh, oh
one.
gosh. I
You know,
don't
things like
know.
Jack the Ripper, who knows?
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
people want to go see Jack the Ripper's grave, you know that. I did look up the Battle of Isandlwana because I needed to get it straight. And Shaka Zulu is way before, about 50, 60 years before, but it is 1879. So those white rocks are a huge part of it. And I'm going to send you a link.
Yeah.
Everyone, just look it up on Wikipedia. But it's fascinating. So he really trained the Zulus. He was the ultimate, like, we're
Yeah.
going to, I mean, the
Right.
battle, those battles were huge. But, I wish. I'm sure they have a monument of him now somewhere, Shaka Zulu somewhere. I just didn't know I was going to have this conversation with you when I was a kid. I didn't know. I would have taken
No.
that photo. I probably do. It's probably in our storage unit in print, like, back at now we have digital. There's a lot of graveyards. You're talking about photography and everything, but now it's kind of laser, these very fancy, and
Right.
I get it, and it's really cool, but there's something about the old school way that is, even if it can't be kept up, it's just kind of nice and soulful to me personally. Just,
Right. Right. But
because.
you look at the cemetery now, and it's you think of it as historically. It represents an era, and that's something else has surpassed it now. And we're too close to it to appreciate it, maybe. So, but I you had mentioned being careful to not to tread on graves. It made you feel weird. I was listening to a program about murderers
See, I
the other
told you,
night,
she her brain goes everywhere. She's not.
and well, I know we don't have much time, but I did want to mention it because it struck me when I saw it. There was a woman who was a murderer, and this would have been in the 19th century, and this was in England. And she was convicted. It was a big show thing. She was hanged in public, and she had a grave, a quite a large grave marker. And there's nothing like 100 years have passed, probably before 100 years had passed, that grave was no longer be able to be seen because people had wanted souvenirs and they had chipped it to death, so they would have a piece of her gravestone and there's nothing left of it anymore. And that's interesting because, people were, I'd say they seemed kind of ghoulish back then, that would be important to them to have a chip off the tombstone of somebody who was super notorious. But people are weird.
No, but the gravestones, it's interesting because O. Henry, so oh he's buried in Asheville, and he wrote the famous piece, The Gift of the Magi. And he wrote, and I've always pronounced it wrong, but I finally got it, I think. Anyway, so it was about a line, $1.87. So people go to the Riverside Cemetery and leave pennies there for him because of that line. And he wrote it in Asheville. And when you go around on the Grey Line trolley tour, they take you around and explain the story. It's really cool. It's a beautiful story. And so what amazed me is that people are putting pennies on Thomas Wolfe's grave. He doesn't care about your pennies. Like, that has nothing to do with O. Henry. But like, people are
No.
doing it on the wrong grave. And I'm like, this is some weird stuff. Like, what are you doing? So I think it's fascinating, but it is, and they're Graves are so simple, yet they're such huge literary characters in our lives, you know? And so I just don't understand. But in the Riverside Cemetery, they do have angels with a cross throughout the cemetery representing Thomas Wolfe's dad, who was in the funeral undertaking business. And he had an angel outside his window when his office was open. Like it was a light. It was like a, we're ready to serve the passing, like a little commercial kind of thing. So it's, I don't want to be that crass, but it was kind of, anyway. So the angels are throughout that cemetery and all, the whole family is there, all together, which, because people started, like you're saying, buying, the plots, and it's a whole industry, with friends that have passed on. I've started to watch. I'm like, oh my God, the burial business is truly it's an industry. It is not just we care for your loved ones, we're going to bury them and be dignified. There's an industry attached. Sorry, I didn't mean to go there, but it's true. It's kind of freaky. Yeah, it is kind of weird, but we've come a long way from rolling people up in a piece of carpet and putting them in a dumpster, right? I'm just saying they used to do
Oh
that.
gosh. Oh
Mob
gosh.
days, mob days in Las Vegas. If anybody goes through Las Vegas, that's where you will not find the artwork that we're talking about. If you're going to go through the desert, but Victoria, always fun. And everyone, again, Victoria's article's up on blendradio and tv.com. Just type in American burials and you'll find it. It's also linked from the show notes, no matter where you're listening, YouTube, Spotify, wherever it is, all linked there. And Victoria, I love our conversation so much. Thank you for letting me go down rabbit holes and getting history wrong and then right. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, it was fun. It was fun. Okay.
So what
I
are we going
will.
to do in December now that we've done gravestones? Like, what are we
Oh,
going to do in
dear. Oh,
December? Oh my, we'll have to
yeah.
come up with something good. Yeah, we'll come up with something good.
Okay.
Take care. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. You can view Victoria Chick's artwork at victoriachick.com. Keep up with us at bigblendradio.com.